This is Scenic Roots Talking Writing. Our guest, Jason Mott, has just published his fourth novel, titled Hell of a Book. It's a series of three different narratives, carefully woven to illuminate the commonalities within the very individual narratives of the three narrators in the novel. This is an excerpt from the audible recording of the novel read by J.D. Jackson. At this point, early in the novel, the principal narrator in the novel, all three remain unnamed throughout the novel. At this point, the principal narrator is 5 years old, and he's acting out the advice he's been given by his father to always be invisible.
He needed to stop this trick he was playing on them. But how? What could he do? He was less than 2 feet from where his parents sat, but guilt over his mother's tears pushed down on the hands that would reach out and touch her and let her know he was there. It weighted down the tongue that would sing her name and free her from fear. There was no way, his 5-year-old mind figured, that he could let them know that it had all been a joke. He could never explain to them that this was all meant to be fun. Not just fun, a celebration. After all, he had done it. For 3 years now, his mother and father had been trying to teach him to become invisible, to become the unseen. That was the name the boy's father gave to it. He said the words with a fantastic tone. He spoke with his hands in the air, sweeping back and forth gently like he was playing some magical instrument. "You will become the unseen," the boy's father said. He added an almost spooky, "Oh," to the end of it sometimes. "You'll be unseen and safe for as long as you live," his father said. "Can you even imagine it?" It was the words, "unseen and safe," that made his father smile. It was the boy's favorite smile, like he was watching his father gain everything he had wanted out of his life. Unseen and safe. Sanctified words. "What should we do?" his mother asked her husband. "Should we just call it quits?" replied the boy's father. He put a spindly hand on his forehead and looked very dramatic all of a sudden, the way people in movies sometimes did. And, yet, the boy thought he saw the beginnings of a smile hiding in the shadows of his father's face. "I mean," the boy's father continued, "if he's gone, maybe we should make like a banana and split. We could pack it all up and head out west somewhere. I hear they got tons of kids out there who need a fine set of parents like us." The boy's mother smiled, as though her husband had told a joke. Humor was one of his gifts. His jokes painted the walls of his family's home in brushstrokes of laughter. But, in spite of the fact that he knew his father was trying to be funny, the boy heard his words and imagined his parents leaving him, and, once again, the sea of fear swelled up inside of him. "No, no, no," said his mother. And just like that, the fear ebbed. "You're right," his father said. "We can never leave him. He's just too great. No other kid in this world like him. So what should we do?" "I have an idea," the boy's mother declared. Excitement filled her voice and spilled over into the boy. His mother always had the best ideas. "We'll cook everything he likes to eat. All of it. One big meal like they used to do back in the old days. And the smell of it will go out all over the world and find him. That'll bring him home." The boy almost cheered. A great dinner of all his favorite things, all of it spread out on the kitchen table, one dish after the other. The idea that the smell of the foods he loved could go out into the world and bring him home. It was like something from one of the books he read at bedtime. All myth and dream and splendor. The boy's father leaned back for a moment and looked at the mother through squinted eyes. "His favorite foods," he said, stroking his dark, narrow chin. "You reckon that'll work?"
"I know it will," his mother said. "He'll smell them. The chicken, the macaroni and cheese, maybe even a sweet potato pie or two. He can never turn down sweet potato pie."
"Pie, you say?" The boy's father licked his lips. "You could be on to something with this scheme of yours. It's got legs, I think.
Just like you."
He kissed his wife's neck, and she laughed the light, lilting laugh that she sometimes did late at night, when the two of them were alone in their bedroom with the door locked.
"Stop that," she giggled.
"I don't know," the father said, his mouth a wry grin.
I still think we might could go out west and find a new kid. I hear they make some out there that actually like to eat their vegetables. The mother laughed, and the boy almost laughed too. No, she chuckled. We'll cook, and he'll come back to us. Just you watch. She stood then, and brushed off her old dress as she always did, and she went into the kitchen. For a moment, the father stayed in the living room and stroked his chin again. Well, kid, he mused, wherever you are in this world, I hope that you know that I would never move out west and try to find another son. You're the only ankle biter I could ever want. Then he stood and went into the kitchen and began helping his wife.
What I love about your book, hell of a book, is that it's it's disorienting. Deliberately, I think.
Good. very deliberate.
Anyway, we can get into that in a moment. I guess we should start at the beginning. So, you wrote your first book. I'm assuming that when you were working at the call center for Verizon during the day, you were writing in the evening, and that's how you finished your first book?
Yeah, that was exactly it. When I came out of college, I had a master's degree in poetry, and believe it or not, no one beats down your door when you've got a master's degree in poetry. So the Verizon was a local company, they had a call center here near where I live, and I took the job because it paid decently and it had good benefits, but primarily because it was a job that ended as soon as you punched out. So I knew that at the end of my day, I could go home and be free to write. So I worked there for 4 years, and I would just make notes during the day, writing notes during the day, and then when I punched out, I would go home and get my writing done, and that's kind of how The Returns, my first novel, happened during that process.
Yeah, I can completely understand that process, because you are so much in a world, in your head at least, and mm-hmm. It would be, if you had to be in another world, which I guess in some ways is the situation the writer who is at the center of your story finds himself. That may be one.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate.
I mean, maybe one of the reasons, it feels so disorienting, because it's so disorienting for him.
Exactly. I wanted the readers to be disoriented, because, as I've been writing for, I've been a full-time writer for 10 years, but, I've been, trying to be a writer for, almost 20 years now. And there reaches a point where you've created so many characters and built so many worlds that, your imagination does start to bleed over into the real world almost. And so I wanted to have a character who really embraced that, and also wanted the readers to be a little bit, to feel that confusion of, is this real or what am I, Yeah, so that was very intentional. I'm glad the readers kind of feel that, but aren't getting completely lost. A little bit confused is okay. I don't want you lost, though.
No. I should quote you back at yourself. At one point in the novel, you say, I've got a condition. I'm a writer. And I think you said that more than once. And the first time you said, okay, so this is starting to fall into place for me now. So we are both one and the same time living inside a man's imagination, while at the same time we're living in the world as he's experiencing it. And it's not just him. There is also his younger self, who is, as far as I know, the only name he ever has is Soot.
There's a character named Soot, and there's also the character of the kid. Now, whether or not these are the younger versions of the author, that is very debatable. I don't want to pin any of that down, but yeah, these other characters that he encounter are very similar to him, but also have slightly different narratives. And again, that goes into the idea of, I wanted the story to be both universal, but also very specific. In many ways, the author sees himself in these other characters, in the stories that they live, but the author also has a very distinct and different life as well. Now, which of those is actually real? That's kind of up for readers to decide as they kind of come through it, I think.
Yes, and there are points. It's almost like reading something written by Hunter Thompson. The whole time I was reading his stuff, I was probably early 20s at that point. Is this for real? How much of this is actually happening, and how much of this is in this man's imagination? And of course, after a while, you just say, it really doesn't matter. This is a very entertaining story. But The more that I read your book, the more I started thinking about Ralph Ellison and his book, The Invisible Man. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, your book is almost the obverse of Ellison's book. Ellison is upset that he's invisible, that people can't see him for who he is, only for what he is. Whereas, you know, the advice given to Thurt is, you should learn how to be invisible.
Yeah, it's interesting that you kind of talked about those two authors in particular. The Hunter S. Thompson similarity is very intentional, no doubt about that at all. Like, I part of, you know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, part of what my love of that novel comes from that. I think he really reflects, even though his is driven by LSD and all kind of drugs, there's a lot of reality in that trip that he's on, and his self-doubting of, like, the writer's life. I think Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas kind of blurs the line between what people think the writer's life actually is and the reality of it. Now, I know for him in particular, like, a lot of that was reality for him, but... And then The Invisible Man, like, a lot of people have made that comparison as well, like the opposite nature of it. Yeah, there was definitely some intention there to play around with that and to you know, we talk about Soot and his parents as they're trying to teach him to become invisible. It's this game that they play where they want to be able to disappear, like their safety in being disappeared and kind of not being seen. And yet part of the black identity in America is that you are always seen, but you're almost never seen for who you are, which does echo back to The Invisible Man.
And you'll have to forgive me, but I didn't see the television show that your first book was based on. But the plot of the story is that people come back to life. And I couldn't help but as soon when I saw that, I thought, oh. So even though people are saying... Well, this is a little different from the three books that Jason wrote before this one, but then that's an echo, isn't it? That idea that, is this person alive or are they dead?
Yeah, that is very, very, very good. So this is a different animal from my previous novels, but it all functions in this place of kind of magical realism and like high imagination, where the reality itself is always turned on its ear a little bit. I think that is one unifying theme in all of my works, that reality gets turned on its ear. And so with this novel, there are a lot of callbacks to The Return. That's why, you know, I think for readers who have read The Return, I hope that when they read this novel, they'll see a few callbacks, because the author in this novel, there are moments where when you hear him discuss the book that he's actually written, a lot of that echoes back to The Return. Like, there are some Easter eggs kind of hidden in there about that. Because I did the impetus for this story did come about when I was on book tour before The Return. So there's some parallels kind of going on there.
Yes. And I'm glad you told me that. I'm going to go back and read the book, because I think this book will be even richer if one has first read The Returned.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope the readers are, you know, it's a book that I wanted to create that would bear up to multiple readings. So there are a lot of kind of hidden Easter eggs and allusions and a lot of subtle ties between characters and a lot of subtle thematic devices that were used in there that I hope that people, I've had a few readers find things, and I think that's been really exciting for me, is like having people find little nuances and little hints. I'm hoping that readers, when they finish it and they may go back to it, they'll start to see even more things in it and more layering. So, yeah, hopefully people will kind of come back to it again and again.
One of the themes in the novel that is wonderfully rendered is what must feel somewhat jarring when you go from the world that you've created and the world that you spent all this time developing and making into a book. And then you go into the world of publishing and understand that they have a whole different attitude to your work than you do.
Yeah, very much so. I definitely poked fun at the publishing world, because that was a very jarring kind of interaction for me. I don't want to demonize people I work with, because I work with some really wonderful people. But I've definitely learned, I've become a bit of a veteran when it comes to the publishing world. Like, as a writer, you see your work as... you know, it is art. It's this child that you've created. You spend years crafting and honing. It's this very dear, delicate piece of art, piece of yourself that you've created. And then when you get into the machine of publishing, you have to remember that, like, for them, yes, it is still art. It is this beautiful thing, but it is also a commodity that is now being bought and sold and steered and engineered and, you know, positioned. And there's nothing negative about that, but it is something that you have to adapt to and learn and really be able to embrace. And that was a challenging part for me, was learning that this is also a part of writing and I have to learn to navigate this. So I did in the novel poke a little bit of fun at some of the people and some of the experiences that I've had, but hopefully not in too negative of a light.
Not really. They're drawn very broadly. And
yeah, exactly.
There's this sense that's not necessarily true, but in order to make a point, sometimes you have to exaggerate.
Exactly.
And I have to tell you, Jason, for my sins, when I first came to the States, the early work I did was in retail and wholesale in the music business.
Oh, wow.
And the first time I talked to a salesman from a record company, he represented a company that had some, in my mind, magical stuff. Joni Mitchell, mm-hmm. Jackson Browne.
Oh, wow.
You know, people of that ilk. And he'd say, yeah, I've got some product for you, son. Here, look at it. And I'd say, well, wow, this is a Joni Mitchell album. This is brilliant. Yeah, how many pieces do you need? You know, and I understood mm-hmm. that, you know, that there's this the parallel universe. You know, I had romantic ideas about music and the music business, and they were swiftly dispelled. and it made me realize that, you know, I should be in radio because I don't have to sell people records. I can tell them about them and be my romantic self.
Yeah, exactly. And I had a pretty similar reaction to things as well.
I can only imagine. I can only imagine. And it's wow. That's fascinating that you are now four books in and a bit like Harry Potter, right? You're sort of creating your own universe.
Yeah, a little bit. I think that's definitely. I'm a big fan of stories and of writers and artists, like directors, who tie together or at least do allusions and nods and Easter eggs, because there are so many writers that I follow and so many directors that I follow. And when I see something that is almost like a gift for like the devout fans, like when a director kind of makes a reference to like one of their earlier films just through a shot or just through a piece of dialogue, I always love that because it makes me feel very special. It makes me really feel rewarded for a lot of the investment that I put into it. And so for me, I wanted to kind of do that with my novels, to be this place where if readers go back through and look at these things, they'll start to notice little parallels and like little callbacks to previous stories and previous characters. And hopefully that'll be something they find rewarding.
Yes, I would think so, because I think on some level, you know, any creative work is essentially a conversation with the reader mm-hmm. or the listener, isn't it? So you are rewarding people by being careful readers, listeners.
Yeah, exactly. That. And I think I know for me, there's an intimacy that kind of gets created there, where like, because I'm one of those people where I grew up being a comic book fan and a Star Trek fan, and like those communities that get formed around the art. I wanted people that, you know, hopefully if there are people who are like avid, you know, readers of my work, like they'll be able to kind of form that community and kind of find those parallels as well, because I know how rewarding that is for me. So I hopefully try to pay that forward to other people.
But while your book in a sense is a meta-narrative, in as much as you are writing about writing, or at least the experience of being a writer, at the same time, part of what makes the book so compelling is the narratives that are threaded together. And so while there's a comedic novel a la Hunter Thompson about a book tour, there's also a very real novel about what life is like when one is born in America as a black person.
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, the purpose of the novel is to bring people, bring readers into this discussion about race in America and identity in America. That is the core goal of the project. And yet, at the same time, I wanted to make it a very personal novel for myself and something that reflected a lot more of who I am than maybe some of my previous works did. And I am the type of person where I do take the life very seriously. I take topics very seriously, and I try to deep dive into very hard topics. And yet I'm also someone who can laugh at myself. I spend way too much time watching B-movies on Sci-Fi Network and just laughing at silly, you know, monsters, giant octopus versus whatever. So for me, comedy and laugh, the ability to laugh at the world and laugh at yourself, this absurdity is a part of who I am. So the novel I constructed in such a way that readers will find themselves hopefully laughing out loud at times and just really being put on, you know, just kind of waving their hands at the book saying, you've got to be kidding me. And then very two pages later, you know, brought to tears almost by some really heavy, powerful moment. Because I think that's what life is. Life is a combination of these highs and lows and joy and terror. And I wanted to include that in the novel.
Oh, you did. And I can't speak for anybody else. But for me, absolutely. It's filled with laugh out loud moments where did you know? you're a very clever writer. And there are times when, I don't know how to put that into words exactly, but at one point in the novel, you alluded to the fact that one of the challenges for all of us is expectations, both mm-hmm. of ourselves. And to be honest with you, Jason, it's something that I've given a lot of thought to, and I've never had anybody else say that. But it seems to me that, you know, the essence of our problems as human beings often is our expectations are not necessarily realistic or not necessarily, I don't know, I just, you kind of set yourself up to be disappointed when you have too many preconceptions of how life will be.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Exactly. Life builds its own narrative, and we try to pretend that we're in charge of the narrative oftentimes. You know, we go to work and we build a family and we make these decisions every day that we wake up, and we feel that we're controlling our lives, we're controlling our narrative. But the truth is that, like, life is part that. Yes, we have some control of our life. There's also just a chaotic, uncontrollable component to things. And so much of the balance, I think, of life is finding where to put expectations and where not to put expectations. And Hell of a Book tries to discuss this place where we put expectations on ourselves as individuals, and then also society puts expectations on us all, and the dissonance that gets created between what we expect of ourselves and our own existence and our own voice versus what society and others outside of who we are expect from us, and, you know, the goals and the shackles they put upon us, trying to balance those two out and trying to find out where the reality of ourselves actually lies. I think that's a difficult moving target to hit. I think something we all shuffle back and forth with and try to navigate every day of our lives from the time we're born. I think it's one of the great challenges of life, is to find out where you exist and who you are.
Yeah, good point. We all develop a public persona, but for somebody who is, if it can be said that a writer is a performer, and I think that when they send you out on a book tour, you are being asked to perform the role of writer, which I think is one of the cool things about the book, is that the writer in the book, who is also the writer of the book, is never given a name. So he is able to kind of step in and out of the roles that are being foisted upon him.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I went back and forth a few times on whether or not to give him a name. There was a draft of the novel pretty early on where I did give him a name, and almost immediately I knew it felt wrong, because it took away a lot of his flexibility as a character. It took away the universal discussion that I was trying to have about certain things. And it also broke with the theme of identity that's being played with the novel. The novel tries to discuss identity and hiddenness and being seen and all those kinds of things. And so I took away his name and just kind of gave him the anonymous moniker of the author. And it's funny because I was really worried about that, because I think with publishers, having unnamed authors is kind of a no-no. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but, like, you know, I think publishers feel that readers always want to know who people are and, like, have these very concrete definitions of things and characters. So I was worried that when I pitched it to people, the unnamed author would be a fight that I would have to worry about. But luckily, I found an editor, really wonderful publisher and editor, who understood the way that this was trying to work, and I was able to kind of keep him unnamed, which served the novel just 10 times better than if I had ever given him a name.
Yeah, the advice given to Soot is be invisible, and that is effectively mm-hmm. what the author is doing.
Exactly.
That's,
and even, you know,
it works on so many levels, your book, you know.
Thanks. And even Soot, you know, Soot is not his actual name.
No.
Like, we never get his real name. You know, Soot's the name that's given to him. So even that character is still, as much as we know about that character, and, you know, he's the only character who does have a name, there's still the reality of who he is. His real name is still kind of lost to mystery for us as readers. So there's a lot of layers there about that.
Well, Soot is given that nickname. I didn't realize that maybe I wasn't paying enough attention, that the people who gave him the nickname are also black. But as he says, how can you be so black? And that's why mm-hmm. he starts calling him Soot. Mm-hmm. But then the kid, who is a kind of, I don't know how to describe the kid. The kid is kind of an alter ego almost, within the flow of the story, keeps popping up, even though at one point there's some question as to whether or not he's even alive. He's also mm-hmm. very black, like Soot.
Yep, exactly. The kid becomes the kid's a unique character. You know, I don't want to give too much away to readers.
No, I don't either. I just want to. that's the line we. It's like being on a tightrope doing these things, isn't it? On the one hand, you want to tantalize people to get them to look at it, while at the same time, you don't want to spill all the beans.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think that one thing readers will find is that the all three of the characters, you know, Soot, the kid, and the author, when you examine them closely, you start to see very parallel themes and very parallel echoes. And you see differences and divergences as well. But that idea that they are sharing almost a unified existence, even as they share very separate existences, that's one of the themes and one of the things I wanted to kind of talk about in the story, in that, you know, the black experience in America is a very unified experience. You know, you talk to a black person in Atlanta, a black person in New York, and a black person in California, and they're going to have very similar narratives about their experiences as a black person in America, and yet they're also going to have very different and distinct, you know, nuances to what that story is and how their experiences are. And that's something that those three characters are kind of working in regard to as well.
Yeah. So there's a universality about the experience, which is, to go back to Ellison, is that of a black person, in quotation marks. Not mm-hmm. a person,
exactly.
Not an individual, a caricature, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And while at the same
time...
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, like, when we talk about expectations and, you know, the roles that society put upon us, like, we're rarely seen as a person. Like, we're, you know, not only black Americans, but, like, I think almost all minorities, like, you are so often just a caricature that is, you know, a shorthand version of what people think you are. You know, they see your skin color, they hear about your gender, they hear about your sexuality, whatever the thing is, and they put you into a little box and you become this caricature of, like, behavior and attitudes, and we're rarely able to see the person behind that. And I think that's one of the tragedies of human interactions, is that we lose so much of people when we shorthand who they are and who they might be. And that's just one of the tough points of life, I think.
It is. But that's what comes across in the book. you are, in effect, putting the reader in a position of understanding. You're caricaturing this person. If you're listening, if you're paying attention, you can no longer do that.
Right.
So while you haven't given him a name, or in fact, you haven't given any of them a name, because, again, as you said, because that way they don't become one person, they become every man or every woman.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so by doing that, it enables you to write a narrative about such a... I can't even imagine how you would begin to assay that topic, especially at this point in history when everybody's talking about it, but nobody's really saying anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a tough topic. And I think my goal was to try to enter that conversation and try to add something to that topic. But I also wanted to do it in a way that I felt was not being very strongly represented. Like, I don't believe there are many voices of, in many black voices in the absurdist novel. You know, absurdist novels rarely discuss black voices. They're really written by black people. And I'm not sure what the cause of that is. I'm not sure if it's just that it's such an unexpected place. And so with this novel, you know, people ask, how do I describe this novel? I tell them it's part memoir, it's part drama, it's part absurdist comedy. And I wanted to be a voice that created a discussion about this very difficult topic of race in America and expectations, but did it through the lens of absurdist writing, because I think that's not a place where many black voices have traveled, and I think it's time for that.
I agree. It's time for it in as much as, again, I think it's enabled you to perhaps get a little closer to talking about something that very few of us, quite honestly, understand. We think we do, but we don't. And I think that's what your book makes clear. What you thought you knew, actually, it's the absolute opposite. It's most of what you are being told isn't what you knew or thought you knew.
Thank you. I'm glad that's definitely one of the goals of the book. That's really great to hear.
Well, it's what it makes what makes the book such a twisty thing to talk about, but so much fun to read.
Exactly.
which is the definition of art, I think. When you make the familiar strange, as my wife likes to say.
I love that. That's a great expression.
Yeah, I think it. Well, I'm really looking forward to reading The Returned, and I'm also curious about where you'll go next as a writer, and I'll wait to see that too.
Cool, thank you very much. I'm glad you enjoyed the book, and hopefully future books, you'll come back and enjoy those as well.
You know I will, yeah. It's so much fun to read, and thanks so much, Jason. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Terrific. Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
Jason Mott's just published novel is hell of a book. This is Scenic Roots, talking writing on listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga.